Let me just pause here and kind of, as a kind of conclusion for my presentation, invite you to just speculate a little bit with me for a moment as to what it is that religion offers that contributes to human flourishing. Why is it that in my country, for example, people who attend church weekly or more are almost twice as likely to say they're very happy as those who never attend? If religious engagement means anything for your well-being, what is it in psychological terms? What's contributing to that effect? What is the religious factor, if we can unpack it a little bit? Should we brainstorm just a bit? Anybody got any ideas? But what else is going on? Yes.
Well, we know that social support is good for our mental health. And maybe, this is just what I'm thinking, maybe a subjective relationship, or that you have a relationship with God, gives you a subjective experience of social support from God.
Okay. So what a friend we have in Jesus.
Yeah.
Social support is a predictor of well-being. And a supportive relationship with God, maybe a supportive relationship with others in community. The very word religion has as its core religio, which means to bind together. The difference between spirituality and religion, my way of thinking, is religion is spirituality lived out within community. You can experience religion, you can experience spirituality in the woods solo. That's an individualistic thing. Religion is a communal enterprise. It's fellowship. It's the ties that bind. And in North America, the United States, and Canada, there are 350,000 local faith communities, each of which are support networks for their active participants when bad things happen. And so maybe religion is a social support variable. So both the vertical and the horizontal dimension of social support could help explain that correlation between religious engagement and well-being. And other ideas, what else does religion contribute? Yes?
It makes us feel like being better people, so, and feeling, helping people, and
okay,
like doing good things makes us feel good.
Okay, so it takes our eyes off ourselves, it mandates compassion. Curiously, depressed people tend to be intensely self-preoccupied and unhappy. And so to the extent that a religious faith compels us to take our eyes off ourselves and live for something greater than self, perhaps that helps. Yes?
A sense of meaning?
Sense of meaning and purpose. And people who live with their actual scales that measure purpose in life, and people who have a strong sense of purpose in life live with greater well-being, and at least some of those people find that their religious faith helps define what that meaning or purpose is for living. These are great, great ideas. Any others? Yes?
Hope for the future.
Hope for the future, for the long-term future. So, bad things are going to happen. But if you believe, no matter what terrible thing may be bothering you this evening, or may bother you deeply in the future, that in the end, the very end, all should be well, and all should be well, and all manner of things should be well. Does that help you cope with the ups and downs of life in the here and now? To have that eternal perspective, that Easter hope? Does it have some psychological as well as religious significance? These are some of the ideas. Indeed, just on my chart too, I mean, it's just, I'm no better than you are, just coming up with the very same ideas. Social support, impulse control is another thing that's been talked about recently. Religion being conducive to self-control and self-regulation. Michael McCullough and a colleague in an article was in Psychological Bulletin note that religiosity is correlated with a lot of good things, such as what we've seen. And he said, well, guess what, folks? Self-control and self-regulation is correlated with all those good things. It's exactly the same relationship. And in fact, we have independent evidence that religious engagement is supportive of self-control, which is the mediating variable for those various successful outcomes. So that's another possibility. And then what we were just talking about, meaning and purpose in life, something worth living and dying for. what we talked about earlier, the kind of good news message that you are accepted, the focus beyond self that was mentioned, and this last point about hope and eternal perspective, which, by the way, is something that comes out of recent experiments also on how people cope with reminders of their own mortality. These are experiments on what's called terror management. So my conclusion from all this, at the end of another little book I wrote recently, which is a friendly letter to skeptics and atheists, is that as an alternative to, on the one hand, purposeless scientism, there's no meaning in the universe, get over it, on the one hand, versus a kind of mindless anti-science fundamentalism that we see a lot of in my country, I'd like to think there's a third alternative, which is a spirituality of humility that is rooted in a faith tradition that crosses centuries, that is ever reforming, a humble spirit that acknowledges that it might be wrong, that welcomes scientific insights, and that at its best helps make sense of the universe, gives meaning to life, opens us to the transcendent, connects us in supportive communities, mandates morality and selflessness, and offers hope in the face of adversity and death. And so that's my good word. The last paragraph of this little book is these words: surely in some ways I'm wrong, you're wrong, we're all wrong. We glimpse ultimate reality as in a dim mirror, constrained by our cognitive limits. Perhaps then we can draw wisdom from both skepticism and spirituality, from both science and religion, by anchoring our lives in a rationality and humility that restrains spirituality with critical analysis, and simultaneously in a spirituality that nurtures purpose, love, joy, and hope. And so that's kind of my little contribution to this conversation. By the way, if any of you, if you don't get copies of the slides and would like them, or if you'd like to communicate in any way, you can do that via my website, which has information about these and other matters, and it's just myname.org. So that takes us to 10:25, but we started an hour late, we finished a half hour earlier, so that leaves us a little time for conversation, but you're welcome to wander out during that conversation if you wish, but I'm here. I'm on American time, and it's only 4:30 in the afternoon. So, comments, questions? Yes.
Thank you for a very engaging and interesting lesson.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I'm not a student anymore, but I once was a psychology student in Bergen.
Okay.
Yeah. And I grew up in eastern Norway. And Norway is a little country, but still the western part is kind of all, what do you call it, the black, traditional Christian area, more conservative Christian thinking is normal. And the eastern part is more secular. And that's where I grew up as a Christian child. I was the only Christian people I knew in school when I was an adult. And I was different, and I had one Christian friend, but that was how it was. I was not, it's all right, it was all right. So then I moved to Bergen in the west side.
Much more secular.
Conservative.
Yeah. Oh, Bergen is?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Oslo is secular.
Bergen is more conservative. Is. Okay.
Yeah. Do you agree?
Yeah. our Bible belts, wraps around the southwestern part.
And I expected then the west
so,
would be different.
When I was
it wraps around through the south then.
Yes. So when I was a student, I moved to Bergen, the western part.
Okay.
And I was surprised because I was in a school there. And one of the other pupils from the West Park, she asked, she wanted to know immediately, who's Christians here? Yeah. Raise their arms. And so I was, it was a kind of aggressive tone in her.
Right.
So
you didn't know whether this was good or bad.
Yeah, I understood this, it's not good to be a Christian here.
Right.
Who are the enemies?
Right.
So I was a bit shocked. because it was not like that in the East. It was the Christians where I grew up. The Christians were just different and strange, but not enemies.
Mm-hmm.
But here they are the enemies.
Okay.
And so first.
So just as we have different religiosity across different states, you do also across different areas of Norway.
Not enemies. I don't the English word for it, but it was.
Right.
It was not positive. And so that was my first shock. Second shock was that half of the there were so many Christians in my class. So I was not used to that. So many Christians around me. And after a while when I studied there, that was a live school. It's a kind of school where many people came from the eastern part, the western part there. And from Christian villages in a way. Where, like, you may this states in the USA, and maybe, or I found out for myself. I think the Christians are have it's not good for Christian to be too many, too many together, because they came from parts where it was they and us. It was the good people, they go to this church and pray and do all the right thing, and the rest is just slum.
Sure.
Yeah. And so,
you know what that reminds me of is research on religious motivation. It's, for example, compare people who have an extrinsic reason for being religious. It does me good in the community, it gets me prospects for my business, it gains social approval. For those who are intrinsically religious, because it's the root of who they are and how they live their lives. And sometimes when you're in a conventionally religious community, it's easier to be extrinsically religious because that's socially approved, but it's not really intrinsically embraced. Whereas if you're religious in a non-religious environment, you're a religious minority, it's probably going to be a more intrinsic religious faith, because you're not doing it for social approval of the people around you. You're doing it because of the deep meaning it brings for you.
And you're not allowed to go around and think that I'm right, everything that I think is right, because all the people around you think differently, and you have you meet different thinking all the time, so maybe you're secure in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. Other comments?
I was just wondering, you were using different definitions of happiness. In your talk, you used different definitions. And I heard another definition is kind of the difference between your actual self and your like thought potential self, or the way that you think you should be. And all those other ways of defining happiness make sense, like that religious, religiousness is good.
Sure.
But that surely, I would think that a lot of religion, at least for me, I think that I would have higher hopes for myself than well.
Right.
But I think, do you know if that's different somehow?
No, that takes me back. I haven't seen much recently written about what Carl Rogers used to talk about, which is the self ideal discrepancy. To the extent that there's a discrepancy between your actual perceived self and the ideal self you'd like to be, you feel a certain unhappiness. And if you can close that gap by raising your self-esteem, ideally, or else by moderating your expectations to a more realistic level, then there's less frustration. Frustration is defined by the gap between expectations and attainments. Increase your attainments or lower your expectations, you reduce your frustration, and likewise for the self-ideal discrepancy gap. So that's a way of increasing happiness, but happiness itself is measured in these various ways, which include just direct questionnaires asking people about their happiness or life satisfaction, to, as I indicated, sampling people's moods over time, or asking people to recall how often in the last 30 days they've experienced different positive versus negative emotions. And to the extent that positive emotions predominate by a huge margin over negative recalled emotions, that's a definition of happiness too, which is the preponderance of positive emotion over negative emotion in the person's life. What we're hoping we're not measuring is just temporary mood fluctuations. That is, whether you're happy or unhappy, you may within a day have really bad moments and really good moments. But we're wanting you to think about your life as a whole and reflect on that. And that's what these questions are trying to drive people to do, not just in the last half hour did something bad or good happen to you. That's mood rather than happiness. Yes?
I was wondering if you were talking about intrinsic and extrinsic religion. And I was presented with this scientific results about death anxiety. Something about intrinsic and extrinsic religion being different in how you experience death anxiety. Do you know anything?
Anxiety?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen that. But normally, extrinsic religion is correlated with things that aren't so good, like racial prejudice, for example. Whereas intrinsic religiosity tends to be correlated with positive indices of human flourishing. So I would guess, given what other evidence we have, that people who are extrinsically religious might be a little more anxious, and that might motivate them to seek out approval by behaving in extrinsic.
And what did you put in the different intrinsic and extrinsic? What was the meaning of those?
What's the meaning of those terms?
Yeah.
Okay, they're studied with questionnaires that ask people what drives their religion. And basically they're asking, I'm religious, no, it's good for business.